This country has been attacked with nuclear weapons. Communications have been severely disrupted, and the number of casualties and the extent of the damage are not yet known.
Welcome to Radio Flash, Armada's dedicated defence electromagnetic spectrum podcast, with your host Tom Withington at the controls. The cheerful words you heard at the start of this recording were from the United Kingdom's four-minute warning. The four-minute warning is embedded in British Cold War mythology. It would have alerted the public that the UK was being attacked with nuclear weapons and the steps that they could take to improve their no doubt modest chances of survival. An incoming nuclear attack would doubtless have prompted retaliation in kind against the aggressor using the UK's own nuclear deterrent. In the 1950s and 1960s, the Royal Air Force's V bomber fleet was the custodian of Britain's nuclear deterrent. A trio of aircraft, namely the Valiant, Victor and Vulcan, could all deliver nuclear weapons of varying yields. Their targets would most likely have been behind the Iron Curtain in the Soviet Union. A new book by historian Dr. Tony Redding, entitled V-Bombers, On Britain's Nuclear Frontline, lifts the veil on aspects of the V-Bomber Force that have hitherto been shrouded in mystery. He joins us today from the United Kingdom. Tony, good to have you with us. Welcome to Radio Flash.
Good afternoon, Tom. Glad to be with you.
So the four-minute warning is, of course, famous Cold War-era folklore. Would the V-bomber fleet have been able to scramble and head towards their targets in such a short amount of time?
Well, the answer to that is yes, but at a very modest level. We have what was described at the time as a minimal deterrent. And a deterrent that is credible is a deterrent that can render damage at a level that is completely unacceptable to the most powerful of aggressors. You're right to start our conversation on this point, because a great deal turns on how many aircraft could get away. But if I could take us just one step back, it's actually interesting that Britain ended up with a relatively small fleet of subsonic bombers, where, of course, the superpowers majored on intercontinental and intermediate range ballistic missiles. There is actually a very good reason for that. It was decided on the day after the plutonium bomb was dropped on Nagasaki to produce a British bomb. And obviously, that would be a free-fall weapon. So the question is, how can it be delivered? And Britain had a close affinity with heavy bombers and was responsible for a very successful strategic bombing campaign against Germany. It was calculated by the West that the Soviet Union could recover sufficiently from World War II by 1957 to start World War III. And it was felt it to be essential in the second half of the 1950s to have an operational nuclear deterrent. And there was concern that the technologies surrounding strategic ballistic missiles were unproven at the time. And it was felt safer to proceed with the now famous bomber types, the Vulcan, Valiant, and Victor. It was felt to be a safer bet than indeed. By 1957, through the introduction of the Valiant squadrons, we had an operational deterrent. But you asked me, of course, about the question of survival of a subsonic bomber force in a world dominated by ballistic missiles from the early 1960s onwards. And I must admit, that puzzled me. Everybody I remember, I'm old enough to remember, as a very young teenager, the four-minute warning and the fear that instilled in everybody. And I couldn't figure out why the British public was told to expect no longer than 4 minutes And yet the quick reaction alert force providing a minimum response to an attack in the V-bomber force was actually at readiness state 15 minutes. It didn't seem to make sense. And would it help perhaps if I explained the difference between the two systems and how that came about?
Absolutely, yes. Help us clear up this time discrepancy, Tony.
Okay, well, first of all, it was one of the more difficult questions I had to face. And sadly, after interviewing over 70 veterans and other experts and examining over 300 declassified documents at the National Archives at Kew, I settled on a fact document which said, here is the reason why we've decided to hold the V-bomber force at Redhead State 15 minutes. I had to put the picture together, but essentially it was the fact that the appropriate response to an imminent threat of attack on the V-bomber airfields was to hold all your aircraft at 5 minutes readiness, which means the crews are in the cockpits, the doors are shut, and all the checks are done up to readiness state 2 minutes, which is start engines. Then you've got a chance, albeit a rather modest chance, of escaping incoming missiles. The reason that 15 minutes was the QRA, quick reaction alert readiness, is really quite straightforward. You couldn't sustain a regime, an operating regime for the V-bomber force based on readiness state 5 minutes. It was just impractical. You couldn't do that. You had 5 minutes. How could you keep crews in an aircraft for 12 hours or 24 hours or whatever? Clearly, that's impossible. But what you could do is have a 15-minute regime and basically practice calling them up to 5 minutes readiness, cockpit readiness, 2 minutes, taxi, or even scramble to practice a war scramble. You could certainly live with a regime like that. But then you're left with a problem. The problem is how to explain the discrepancy between 4 minutes and 15 minutes. I remember the old joke in the 1950s that people asked each other, what are you going to do if the four-minute warning sounds? And obviously there were some risque and rather vulgar responses to that. And, but underlying all that was a real fear. Everybody was conscious of the fact that the world as we know it could come to a stop in the space of 4 minutes. It was a really strange time. Now, getting on to the 15 minutes, how to explain this in a semi-convincing way? And the answer was this. It was argued that the Soviet Union had an interest in launching their missiles in a staggered way. So they would seek to achieve simultaneous burst of the weapons in Europe, including the UK and the United States, particularly the United States Midwest. Well, I couldn't see any military advantage for doing that. I looked for it, I couldn't find it, and frankly, in many ways, I thought it was a nonsense. I mean, the fact of the matter is, why would the Soviet Union pass up the opportunity to destroy almost all the nuclear assets of the West in Europe by giving them, in effect, a longer American warning? In other words, the missiles in a staggered launch, the first wave of missiles would be targeted at the United States, and a second wave coming 7, 8, 9 minutes later would be targeted at European nuclear bases. It's complete nonsense. Why would you announce to Europe 9 minutes before launching missiles against them? It doesn't make sense. Until you begin to realise what's truly going on here? And the key to it is this. In early 1962, Bomber Command initiated quick reaction alert, and under that, one bomber out of eight aircraft in each V-bomber squadron was held 24 hours armed and fueled and ready to take off. Talking about on the main bases. So that was the 15-minute regime. So the chaps had to get their gear and their go bags, as they were called, their target folders, their maps, and all the rest of it, and rush into transport, which were usually elderly and unreliable staff cars. Race to the aircraft, if the staff car worked, get in the aircraft and go through the ritual to prepare to prepare to take off. So that would be the 15-minute regime under quick reaction alert. But the key issue and the thing that gave the whole thing away, really, was a description of what happened a year earlier in 1961. In 1961, Bomber Command introduced something called Alert Condition 1. Under Alert Condition 1, which would be declared on the cusp of war, the bombers would be dispersed in tiny packets of one, two, maybe four aircraft to bases, airfields all around the UK, to their dispersal airfields, and they would be armed, and on landing they would be refueled and regenerated and ready to go. Now, for most of the, well, certainly the second half of the 1960s, because the Valiance, the first of the V-bomber types, was retired in 1965 because it had airframe fatigue problems. So that obviously reduced the V-bomber fleet quite considerably. In a war situation post-1965 and the retirement of the Valiance, we probably would have had around 88 operational V-bombers. And of the 88, around 80, in all probability, would be generated in a war situation, assuming that we were given a chance to generate them. But making that assumption and assuming that the political will existed to order dispersal, we would have about 80 aircraft. And it was decided that 30 of the 80 aircraft would be manned round the clock, cockpit manned at 5 minutes. So the 30 aircraft would have something called flight alert targets. And these targets were, in fact, the most important targets, the priority targets, in other words, the very big cities, including Moscow and Leningrad. And they would be, in effect, double crewed. So you would have relief crews, or two crews basically rotating on each aircraft, maintaining cockpit readiness 24/7. So 30 aircraft at that state, that would require 60 crews. We had actually around 110 crews in all. So 60 from 110, that would leave 50 crews, and the 50 crews would man the other 50 aircraft. And they would actually be on cockpit manning in the hours from 3 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock. So during that period, all 80 bombers would in fact be with cockpit manned with the doors closed and all checks done up to readiness state 2 minutes, start engines. So this was pretty profound. And it told me that was the real preparation for serious intelligence, making it clear that the Soviets planned to attack the airfields. That would have been the response, assuming that we had a government with the courage necessary to do that, which wasn't the case during the Cuban crisis, where the aircraft stayed on their main bases. That was a very long, complicated explanation, but hopefully that sort of shed some light on it. There was an operational regime that the V-bomber force lived by, which was 15 minutes, but in a close approach to war, alert condition one could be declared, and the aircraft would then disperse.
Glad you've cleared that up for us, Tony, because it's something that has stuck in my mind regarding that discrepancy, because I've read that before regarding the V-bombers, and it's very useful in your book that you've addressed that and tackled that. And assuming that this proportion of the aircraft are able to leave their bases uninterrupted, unhindered by the incoming nuclear attack, how deadly do you believe was the threat from Soviet ground-based air defences as those bombers then made their way towards their targets?
Well, I think the really important thing about the V-bomber force is not its paper strength. What really counts is its strength after a first strike on the airfields. And there were some really very interesting papers at Kew for Bomber Command's operational research branch. And together, it took some doing, but you can put the picture together of how the system would work. And I asked myself the question, what would it take for a crew to survive a war scramble? It was thought that four Soviet nuclear weapons would be targeted on each airfield, probably two missiles and two airdropped weapons. We're talking about the second half of the 1960s here. So what would it take to survive? And the chances of survival were, frankly, fairly remote. I can take you through what it would be. If you were in a crew, let's say you were the captain of a Vulcan and you were dispersed in an alert condition one declaration, this is what would need to be the case if you had a chance of survival. You'd need to be in the aircraft with the doors closed and the checks done to readiness state 02, which is 2 minutes start engines. You would need to be first in the queue for takeoff. You would have to hope that the first missile landing was late. And obviously, it wouldn't be possible to achieve simultaneous detonation across the airfields. The missiles would probably land in a period of around 2 minutes. And we're talking about a situation where literally every second counts. You would have to hope that the missile was a dud. Probably a quarter of them would have malfunctioned. Again, we're talking about the mid-1960s. And of course, you could always hope that the missile was somewhat off course. So you can see that there's really not much of a chance. I think one of the keys would be, and I'm sure this would be the case, although I was unable to find any documentary proof, that the 30 aircraft that would be cockpit manned round the clock would have been based at airfields in the far west and the far north, because geographically that would give you slightly more missile warning. And of course, you can't launch until the missiles are confirmed as being in flight. So a perfect place to be, if that's an appropriate word, would be Ballycally in Northern Ireland. You're going to be in a situation where very few of the aircraft survive. My guess is that probably around 8 to 10 aircraft out of the 80 would have survived, and almost all of them would have been amongst the alert condition one, 30%, about 30 aircraft that were cockpit manned round the clock. 30% would give you 24 aircraft. I'm sure we would have squeezed in a few more, possibly taking up to about 30, but they had the best chance. Now, my lead examiner doing my PhD was Professor Richard Overy, who's quite a famous World War II historian. And I remember during my viva, he said to me, well, it doesn't sound much like a credible deterrent. And I realised that, in a way, he'd been conditioned, as many people are, by numbers of aircraft in relation to the campaigns of World War II. What you have to remember, although we might have only 8 or 10 V-bombers surviving to start their passage across the North Sea in a retaliatory attack, each one of those V-bombers could carry a warload with an explosive potential equal to up to 175,000 wartime Lancasters. The key thing to remember here is that each V-bomber had the potential to carry the explosive warload of 175,000 Lancaster bombers in World War II. It's a figure that beggars belief. It takes something to get your head around that. But I think the point is made by, let's say there were, for the sake of argument, 10 survivors and 5 of them were lost attempting to penetrate the defences, but 5 aircraft actually survived and successfully released weapons. They would be releasing their weapons almost certainly on Moscow and Leningrad, the first and second cities of the Soviet Union, and they would be releasing more high explosive equivalent on those two cities in the first couple of hours of World War III than all the Allies' bombs dropped on Germany throughout 6 years of a very long war in World War II. So, in fact, it certainly is a credible deterrent. We were not trying to destroy the entire Soviet Union. What we were trying to do is to a level of damage, inflict a level of damage that was entirely unacceptable to the Soviet Union, in the sense that it would place them at a very strong disadvantage to the United States. We were trying to destroy, unilaterally have the capacity to threaten to destroy the balance between the superpowers. So although a very small number could survive a missile strike, the important thing to remember here is that the Russians could not guarantee that they would destroy every aircraft on the ground or indeed in the air as they try and penetrate the defences. And the explosive potential of each of those attackers is just tremendous.
Now, I was very pleased in your book to read some of my favourite RAF colour code words for the various electronic warfare systems that the V-bombers had during the Cold War. Red Shrimp, Red Steer, Green Palm, these are just 3 of the codes. Yes. Some of the nuclear weapons had similarly eccentric names, at Yellow Sun, Red Beard, for instance. But sticking with the EW side of things, how effective do you think these countermeasures would have been against the formidable array of air defences the Soviets had at the time, and using those countermeasures to disrupt Soviet radar, radio communications, that kind of thing?
Well, the answer is probably not very effective. The reason for that is fairly straightforward. The original equipment outfit, the ECM, Electronic Countermeasures Outfit, for V-bombers consisted of barrage jammers called Red Shrimp. There was a Green Palm fighter communications jammer and a Blue Diver system connected with warning and jamming. Green Palm was focused on jamming the fighter recovery channel to make it more difficult for fighters to find their airfields when low on fuel. But the real problem here turns on what happened to the V-Force. It had a golden age in the late 1950s and very early 1960s, but that really all came to an end on May the 1st, 1960, when the Soviets shot down Gary Powell's U-2. It was shot down by an SA-2 surface-to-air missile, one of a considerable number that were fired at it. But nevertheless, it was brought down, and it was brought down from a height of 70,000 feet. which is considerably higher than the operating altitude of the V-bombers that were designed for high-altitude nuclear attack sorties. So the question is, what to do at that point. It wasn't particularly worrisome in the sense that we were going to buy the Skybolt air-launched ballistic missile from the Americans, and that had a range of something like 1,000 miles, perhaps a little more. And that would mean that most of the targets could have been reached without entering defended airspace. So you don't need sophisticated ECM, or you certainly don't need them as much if you're not going to enter defended airspace. But in 1962, at the end of 1962, Prime Minister Macmillan met with President Kennedy in Bermuda, and the Americans told the British the Skybolt was to be cancelled. I think Macmillan was very clever because he created a huge fuss and accused the Americans of wanting to destroy the special relationship. And I can't imagine Harry Wimbledon jumping up and down, but certainly he must have come fairly close to it. And I believe that the whole of that was an act. The British, at least a year and possibly longer before the Bermuda meeting, recognised that Skybolt was not the answer to our deterrent problems. What we wanted was Polaris. Polaris represented a much more secure launch platform with a weapon system that certainly had a much better chance even then of hitting the target, the targets than a small fleet of subsonic bomber survivors. Definitely Polaris was the preferred system. But the Americans would only supply it on condition. And the condition basically was that it should be a European Polaris force rather than a British force. That was unacceptable to the British. They wanted an independent deterrent. And Macmillan came back from Bermuda with Polaris without strings. I mean, it was an absolute stroke of genius. It was the ideal. And in its Trident format today, it is the ideal small nation deterrent. We'll put aside for the moment the fact that the last two Trident launchings were failures. Maybe we can come back to that later. So we ended up with a situation where they had Polaris, but the real problem was that it would take 6 years at least before the Polaris patrols would begin. And in fact, the handover of the strategic nuclear deterrent to Polaris happened in mid-1969. So the issue was, how can you stay credible for 6 years when clearly high-altitude nuclear attack is a non-starter? And it was decided. In fact, all the key decisions, when he came back from Bermuda, it was hugely impressive. He came back from Bermuda and, Skybolt, we're not going to get Skybolt. Well, in fact, you know, he got the promise of Polaris, which was a far superior system. How are we going to maintain credibility on the V-bomber force until Polaris comes along 6 years later? And the answer was that we would employ extreme combat tactics. So the idea was that instead of high-altitude nuclear attack, the V-bomber force would become a low-level nuclear strike force. And it wasn't too long before 500 feet was regarded as too high in pressing home a nuclear attack. Also, the decision was taken to convert the V-force's only standoff rocket weapon, which was Blue Steel 1. A new variant was produced that could be launched as low as 250 feet. And eventually, the Freefall squadrons were equipped with a weapon called WE-177B, which had an explosive potential of 450,000 tons. of high explosive, and it's not much more than 7 feet long. And it was an incredible weapon. It could be dropped from as low as 100 feet or even lower, and it was parachute retarded. The aircraft would be flying at 415 knots, so once only speed over the target, straight over the target. It would release the weapon, and the parachute system would immediately reduce it to a landing speed of 112 miles an hour. It could survive up to 2,000 G of impact when it hit a building, a truck, or whatever. And it would make a hole 300 feet deep and half a mile wide. And the attacking aircraft would have 1 minute to get away. So we had a response to the fact that we didn't have effective ECM. And the reason for that, well, there are several reasons, but one of the reasons is there was never enough time to develop the systems and then get enough operational service out of them to make it worthwhile. That was one issue. Another issue was the V-bomber force was so small in relative terms that taking aircraft out of service for lengthy periods for conversion, the installation of new ECM systems, for example, reduced the frontline force to perhaps a dangerous level. There are all sorts of things to consider, but when the V-force went low, the main thing to remember is that even if you've only got, say, 10 aircraft, they're going to be penetrating the coastline at different points, and they will only face a tiny slice of the very powerful defences, the air defences the Soviets had. And the key thing was to stay electronically silent. And if it's daylight, don't be spotted. So airfields were always carefully avoided on the route plan to avoid being spotted as the the Vulcan and the other types could trail black smoke. And Soviet fighter pilots who ran out of missiles and gun ammunition were briefed to ram the bombers. So that was a very serious threat, certainly serious, taken seriously by the crews. So the question was, you've got, let's, for the sake of argument, you've got 10 aircraft trying to penetrate at different points. They would have to cross the coastal defence belt. They would have to then cross to their targets. That would mean they would face the area defences, including the long-range fighters and gun systems, and obviously SAM sites. And then they would have to confront the point defences around the big city targets. Moscow had three belts of SAMs, for example. The problem for Blue Steel, the standoff bomb, was that it had 150 miles range at high altitude, but that reduced down to, well, 30 to 50 miles at low level, which takes you dangerously close to the outer defences. And as for the 3-4 crews, well, they were expected to penetrate and overfly the target. So, I think it's fair to call them extreme combat tactics.
Tony, it's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
You can order a copy of Tony's book online, and it's also available in all good bookshops. Having devoured it at the weekend, I can certainly highly recommend it. Also, you can visit Tony's website at tonyredding.co.uk. And don't forget, there's more electromagnetic spectrum news and analysis at armadainternational.com. That's all we've got time for. Thanks for listening.